Welcome to Ampersound, a podcast brought to you by the team at Visualist. Ampersound features snippets from our interactive digital magazine, Ampersand. Every episode, we speak to multi-hyphenates who have captivated our minds. We ask them about their code switching, routines, and mindsets. For the full stories, check out ampersand-mag.com. That's ampersand-mag.com. Don't forget to like, follow, and subscribe. Today, I'm talking with designer, poet, painter, and flower girl in chief, Sana Rao. We chat about how she defines her identity, when she first called herself a poet, and why solitude is important to her. Thanks for joining us. We hope you enjoy the stories. I know your Twitter bio says that you are flower girl in chief and poet in residence. So tell me about that, please.
Good time to ask about flowers. Well, it's spring outside and I live in London. So London in spring is just prolific. It's just absolutely gorgeous, even though it's a bit delayed at the moment. But yeah, I kind of started a project last year where I was like painting flowers every day. I've always been a little bit like obsessed with flowers too. A lot of people around me get annoyed by that, but yeah, so that's where the flower girl in chief comes from. And obviously, like, poetry I've been doing for a really long time, probably about 15 years now, but only recently I was on my sabbatical, so I really started pursuing it seriously and kind of going and connecting with other poets in the community, writing and submitting and publishing. And I started my own poetry curation newsletter, which basically I send out twice a month. So there you go.
Your newsletter, which I'm subscribed to, it's called Found. Mm-hmm. Why the name Found? What's the significance?
Yeah, so before Found Poems, actually, I used to run another poetry company called Postcard Poets. I used to basically send poetry on like actual real snail mail postcards to people across the world. And I kind of stopped it because I was also doing my thesis at that time. But Found Poems was, I think, a little bit of an inspired name, because if you know about the found art or found poetry movement, it is all about the kind of moments of beauty or serendipity that you find in the ordinary. I think intention was that people who don't look at poetry as an accessible thing or like poetry very much or read very much poetry because of the way that they were taught poetry growing up, it was obviously very academic for a lot of people, or inaccessible for a lot of people, it would become more human and accessible, and kind of just you're walking by on the street and you notice a little verse on a little street corner and kind of appreciate it in that moment.
Going back a little bit, I know you grew up in India, and I'm curious, what were some of the first things that you were interested in as a child? Was poetry one of them? Did you grow up painting and like drawing and painting all the time?
Yeah, I think it was a way for me to just kind of probably put myself in a little bit of a creative bubble. I wasn't very good with a lot of academics, but painting and art was definitely felt very, very natural to me. Poetry, actually, surprisingly, I came to very late in life. I only started reading poetry in probably like the last year of uni in India. I picked a poem as a part of my graphic design final kind of a thesis, where I had to illustrate this amazing, really the longest ballad that has been written. And I think that's when I really got into poetry. But yeah, growing up, I was always really into art, because I always found that I was never really like the academic student in the kind of like the way that the Asian communities define academics. So I was never, I was interested in like mathematics and English and decent enough at it, but I was a visual thinker and a visual learner.
I see. Your day job is your VP of product at Peanut. Tell me a little bit about that day job, side hustle, passion project thing. Like, how is that part of your identity, the different aspects of your interests, your work, your life?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good. Identity is a really good word, because I think a lot of people who work in the tech community or generally work like in a capitalistic society tend to look at work as the way that they define their identity. And I think it was very true for me as well, because, you know, very type A, coming from like, you know, Asian parents, you tend to define achievement as a way to define your identity. And actually, only when I left my previous job, and I was on a little bit of a sabbatical, and I didn't have work, and I wasn't really like achieving or producing something, is when I kind of started to pick apart what identity even is and why I felt the need to define my identity by the achievement or the day job or the work that I do and the employment that I have. Mm-hmm. And I think that's when like I actually started defining myself as like the poet or the painter or those things, because I was always like hesitant to claim these titles in my identity because I wasn't achieving something in them, or I wasn't being employed by them. And so if you look at my Twitter bio or anywhere else, I actually now say that I am like a poet or whatever else first. And then like on the side, I kind of also work, not to say that I don't derive any joy from my work, which I absolutely do at this moment, but it is not the primary source of my identity.
I love that. I love that you're owning what makes you you. When did you feel comfortable calling yourself a poet?
That's a good question. It wasn't very long ago, even though I've been writing for a really long time. But I think it was actually, I was working with a leadership coach during my sabbatical. And it was very interesting because I wasn't leading anyone during that time. So it was very interesting because I was like, well, I don't need to work with you anymore. And that leadership coach from design department, she was basically like, no, you're still leading yourself. Let's talk about what's important to you and what your values are. And during that conversation, I actually like realized that the thing that gives me most joy, I don't have to like have any external validation or external employment or achievement in order to claim that as a part of my identity. That's at Poetry Cafe in London. And they do open mic nights on Tuesday night, 7 to 10. And anyone can go and sign up. And I think if I hadn't discovered that, I don't know if I'd be able to claim poetry as my own, because I think I just started going there slowly just to listen to people. And then when I saw the variety of people who were kind of taking a chance, I was like, well, why not me then? And so I just took a chance and actually started going there very, very regularly. And like, I think about a year and a half or so ago, I actually was like, I'm going to call myself a poet because I'm doing it. I'm writing and I'm going to poetry open mics. I'm going to workshops and courses and doing this stuff. So I'm just going to sit with it and see how it feels.
Wow. Do you remember your first open mic night? What you felt?
I was terrified. I had never shown my poems to anyone or actually recited my poems in front of anyone. And this, here I was in front of like 60 people. And because poetry is so emotional and personal for me, a lot of those poems were extremely raw and extremely vulnerable. And it was basically like, you know, opening up your heart to a group of strangers. One, like, you don't know how good you are. And so there's that judgment, but also it's like really personal material. I just remember like shaking and just standing in front of people going, oh my God, I can't believe I'm doing this. But like, I think I just started saying that I've been writing for 15 years, but this is the first time at an open mic night for me, and people just lost their shit. They were like clapping and hooting. The community is really, really supportive. You can write absolute trash and they would still like cheer you on as if you are the most poetic genius they've ever come across. And I think that community really helped build up my confidence in claiming that space for myself.
You mentioned that you were on a sabbatical. What led to that sabbatical, or what did you do on that sabbatical?
What led to a sabbatical is a long story, but yeah, I was basically very, very burnt out by being in the tech community, by being mostly largely in like early stage hyper growth startups or in environments where generally I like weren't really set up for my success or like a person who looks like me. Yeah, I think I was just really, really burnt out. And I intended to take like a month of break, but my body was like just not having it. It was like, nope, you're not going back. And so for the first few months, I tried to still do some productive work by reading a lot or painting flowers and writing poetry. But for the most part, I was doing nothing. I was like just being, I was talking to my friends, reconnecting with people, painting when I felt like, reading when I felt like, writing when I felt like.
What are some of the routines or rituals that you have now that help you to, I guess, stay connected with what you physically or mentally need?
Yeah, I think the reason I had the burnout obviously was because I didn't have any practices in place, which allowed me to kind of take a step back. And actually, it's interesting because working from home has really allowed me to do that, because when you're in your own space, you're in control and you're basically like, you can check in on your body. If you're feeling fatigued, you can go step away from the computer. You're not kind of in an external environment where you're kind of have to perform and you mm-hmm. have to be visibly there and on your computer and working all the time. But I'm now very regimented about looking at my energy, feeling my energy levels. So if I feel like my energy is dropping, I'm feeling mentally fatigued, I will book a mental health day and I kind of make sure that everyone on my team knows that I'm taking a mental health day so that they can feel that they can take it too. So right now I try to like maybe every 2 or 3 weeks I take a day of just mental health day where I will just, well, I'll just not look at a computer, not look at a screen, not think about work and just like read or, you know, write, do whatever it is that I want to do.
You obviously give a lot of time and energy to you. Your work at Peanut, your work as, or your joy with poetry. I don't know, would you call poetry work for you?
Well, it's life, isn't it?
Yeah. What else do you give your time and energy to?
Well, right now I'm in the middle of purchasing a house, buying a house. So a lot of my energy, I think is in like kind of nesting or trying to figure out what I want the space to be. I've never really had the privilege to be in a space where I could like do it in the way that I wanted to. And now that is taking time, obviously my relationships, my family, the situation in India, obviously with COVID is really, really bad at the moment. And a lot of people I know personally are affected by it really badly. So obviously that's taking a lot of my time and that's pretty much it. But and obviously like physical well-being, health. I lift weights a lot and that is actually probably one of the things that has kept me really, really sane through this whole time.
Weightlifting, how does that contribute to your mental health besides physical?
Oh my God, huge, huge. I mean, obviously like there's so many hormonal benefits and kind of that are already written, but I think for women, again, it's the thing that I feel like women don't do it because they feel there's all these kind of like notions around what weightlifting does to your body, but there's not a lot of talk around what it does to your brain, and especially for women who are constantly kind of socialized to be the subservient people in society. I feel like weightlifting gives you a kind of strength and a kind of, just like, I wouldn't call it dominance, but just like a kind of strength and I don't know, something changes in your brain. There's a chemical change in your brain or I don't know if it's an attitude thing, but it just makes you feel like you own the room. Like maybe it makes you feel like a man does all the time, but.
You've lived in different places, London, the SF Bay area, India growing up. Firstly, how would you define home now? And secondly, how do you feel it being between places, not, you know, physically, but in that intangible sense?
Yeah, totally. And also a really great question, because I feel like any immigrant struggles with that question. I struggled with that for a really long time. I left India about 10 years ago. And I left India, I thought that it's going to be just for a 2-year master's program and I'll go back because everyone I know is there. All my family is there. I have a twin sister who's in India.
Okay.
And so it was very much like, well, of course, this is just an educational thing and I come back. And then I never ended up going back. And when I moved from San Francisco to London, it was also supposed to be a temporary, like, 6-month assignment with Twitter. And then I would go back to San Francisco. Then I never ended up going back. So I think it was always a thing for me, like, what is home? I just felt unmoored for a really long time. And I think after about 5 years or so of not having a permanent residence, I think I kind of just started looking at home as wherever I am. And so I have like little objects around me or whatever, wherever those objects are or wherever I am is home. And then like, I think I started feeling a lot more settled in kind of wherever I was. And obviously now that I've been in London for like 5 years and I've actually bought a house, that feels like a really momentous, like the fact that I've bought a piece of land, mm-hmm. Which I've never kind of thought that I would want to commit to a place long enough to buy a property. And I think the thought was really scary to me to commit to a place, because in my mind, I always thought I'd move more and more and more. But yeah, London is amazing. I absolutely adore London.
I think I read on your website that you've done a lot of conferences, or you've spoken at a lot of conferences about communication, and particularly, I might butcher this, I think it's called feminine coded communication. Can you tell me a little bit about that interest in feminine coded communication and how that came about?
Yeah, that's a great question. So yeah, I did a talk very recently, actually, at Leading Design Conference, mm-hmm. and it was about safety, mm-hmm. And how do you create safety? And I think one of the things I realized when I had burnt out was, like, you know, I was excelling in that space. I was, you know, I was getting promoted. It wasn't that I had any dearth of opportunity but I think what I realized when I left was that I burnt out not because I wasn't doing the work. I burnt out because I didn't feel safe in those environments. And that wasn't the overt kind of like racism or any of those things that you'd see, because I think most spaces in tech have moved on from that kind of overt, not always, but I think the overt explicit things that you would see earlier on are not there anymore. But I think what I realized was that safety is created when all views are equally present and equally valued. And what I realized, I think when I first joined tech, actually, and because I was so junior at that point, I always thought, you know, it's just a way of communication I have to learn. But I never thought of it as like a masculine style of communication. But because I've done so much research into this, what I realized was that there's very distinct styles of communication. And because these environments, tech and industry and general companies, are so dominated by men, the communication style and what people are targeted to do and how they are judged or evaluated is very much defined by those people. And so either you adapt to that. And I remember thinking about it early in my career, that any of the women I saw in like exec roles or senior leadership talked, walked, dressed exactly like the men on the team. And I remember pointing it out to my boss, going, well, I'm not like any of them. So am I never going to be like one of those people? Or do I have to become, is that how people talk when they get to that level, or behave when they get to that level? Because there are a lot of things in research, which I found are very coded in terms of the way women communicate. It's the kind of like the just or the sorries and the like, oh, like, and these things that women say all the time and are told to like stop saying, stop apologizing, just be clear, just be direct. All of those things are things like men do, or masculine coded communication style like does, to dominate the room, because it's all about dominating and superiority, and not about, everyone should have an equal chance in the space to talk. I want to connect to you as a human. And that's something that, like, I think feminine coded communication styles that women generally are socialized to do and naturally do anyway. And this is something I see very much in Peanut, in the company I'm at, where the app is all for women.
Yeah.
So the kind, I don't know if you've ever seen it or used it, but the kind of content you'll see on Peanut is drastically different from any kind of open platform you'd see, because it's all women. and the way they talk to each other and the way they communicate with each other, the vulnerability, the trust on the platform is just drastically different. And I think that was the first time where I actually hit home to me what happens when you give a space where that masculine coded communication style just doesn't exist.
Wow. Were you actively seeking out a role in which this type of feminine coded communication would be center stage? Or was that just happens?
No, it happened. I had been reading in my sabbatical, actually, one of the first books I picked up was by this researcher called Jennifer Amherst. And she's written this book called Proposals for the Feminine Economy. And I read it and after that, I've done so much of research. I was obsessed with that book. It's literally always on my table. And I think when I first talked to Pina, because I had been thinking about that space for so long and wanting that for myself, but obviously at that point, I didn't think that existed in any any tech company specifically. I just didn't think that was possible. So I actually was in the mind of thinking I might have to do it myself. I might have to start a company where that kind of culture exists. And then when I talked to the CEO of Peanut, Michelle, and actually talked her through this principles and heard from her side, I was like, that couldn't be a better fit.
Wow, that's amazing. You did a talk recently at Leading Design. Is that something that you are expanding? It's almost like an academic interest or like a subject matter expertise kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, I don't have an actual like end game to this because I think it's something that I'm forever interested in because I know that like there's so many times I've had to adapt or been told to adapt and people around me, like even in my management style, I remember giving feedback to people to not do those things. And then kind of tracking back and say, wait, am I saying that? Or I'm passing that on feedback because that's the feedback I've gotten. So it's like a forever interest for me. And I'm always reading up more about this. It's like a side academic research interest.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll write a book about it. Maybe I'll do more talks about it. But at the moment, I think my focus is to just, you know, tell as many people as possible, and especially women as possible about it so that they understand that there is validity in the way that they communicate and they don't have to adapt and change their styles.
It's interesting that like you called it like a side academic interest that feeds in so directly into your day job. I call it day job, but you know, just for semantics. What about poetry? Is there an intersection with what you do at Peanut or are they completely separate?
At the moment they are completely separate, but Peanut uses a lot of poetry we use a lot of poetry in our branding and the brand messaging because poetry is to me an inherently feminine any kind of creation really, but poetry is inherently feminine act. It's about acknowledging your feelings. It's and a lot of people think about it as like an intellectual activity, then that's fair, that's fine. But for me, like poetry is an art. Any of these things are actually like feminine activities because they're about creation. And what's more feminine than creation? And Peanut is a social network. Social connection is to me inherently feminine in nature. So there are I would say like if you had to draw a connecting line through all of my work and all of my interests, this would probably be one of those core connecting lines that I can foresee going forward for pretty much everything. And probably the reason I like poetry is because it helps me. I tend to get very rational a lot of times and just kind of like rationalize a lot of emotions. And I've had to kind of come back, and poetry helps me come back and like get back in touch with the emotions and the humans and the vulnerability behind everything.
Amazing. How would you describe your poetry and your creations?
For the most part, a lot of my poetry is very much about human relationships or about kind of like meta patterns that you see. I think a lot of art and a lot of design actually even is about connecting the dots and connecting the patterns where kind of a kind of ordinary person or someone outside those disciplines might not be able to see those patterns and see those similarities. And I think like the way I write poetry, at least, is very much the juxtaposition or the patterns that you might kind of move between two entirely dissimilar things so that you can reveal the kind of similarity in them.
That was very, that was almost poetic. How do you write poetry? Does the poem find you, or do you find the poem?
That's a really good question. Have you read Anne Lamott's Bird by Bird?
No, I can't say I have.
It's a beautiful book. And actually, she says something like, a poem is like a train. It just comes by. It like comes by with a big rush, and you either jump on it in time or it leaves you. And sometimes you realize that it's passing you by too late, and you try to pull it back, and then in which case it comes like outside in or backwards in. So I think that's a metaphor that I can totally describe, that like it's not a thing that I do intellectually, that I sit and say I'm going to craft a poem. It's almost like it's like a train, and I jumped on at the right time and I caught that thought.
I love that analogy. So with the train, do you create conditions that allow you to jump onto that train easier to catch that train? What are some tricks that you've taught yourself to be able to catch that train or jump onto that train?
I think the main thing that I feel like I need for myself in order to like write or create anything at all is solitude. You need to be able to keep yourself away from all the other people and all the other influences and all the other responsibility to understand what is your voice and what is your thoughts, detached from everything else and everyone else. And I think one of the things that I always try to do, obviously, when things were open, or I would just go to a cafe and just sit by myself with music in my ears and take one of my favorite poetry books and just read with no expectation that something would come. And you have to have like a couple hours of that, like taking everything away from your brain for it to make space for new creative things to come into the brain.
Wow. Have you always done that?
Yeah, I think I've done it. I don't remember when I've not done it. Mm. At least since I started writing, probably like 10, 15 years ago.
What music do you listen to? Do you even pay attention to the music?
No, it's just kind of ambient. And I actually like to, because I write poetry in English, I listen to music in Hindi so that it's not interfering with my English like thoughts. It's kind of just sitting in the background, and it's comfortable to hear because it's Hindi and it's like my mother tongue. So I can hear it and yet not get distracted by it. And it's the opposite. Like if I'm writing in Hindi, I'll listen to English music.
Do you write poetry in Hindi?
Not a whole lot. I write a little bit of combination of Hindi and Urdu, but I'm not very fluid at it, because I think I've been outside India for so long that English now has become the default language I think in.
Fascinating. Do you write on paper or do you type?
Paper, always.
Why?
I feel like, so this is interesting because I've had this conversation with my boyfriend a lot, because he writes with paper, and I used to write with type. And you can always tell when a poem has originated from a paper or from a screen. I just feel like you approach things entirely differently, because on a screen, it's quicker, it's faster. It's also like you can edit, you can look at things, you can look at meanings, you can Google names, thesaurus, you can get distracted. It's much more rational and clear-cut a language whenever I write on the computer. But when I'm writing on my paper, it's more fluid, it's more exploratory.
Do you write at home, or do you write in cafes or in the park or somewhere else?
Different places. Like obviously COVID, that has changed a lot of our behaviors and where we do what, because everything's happening in the home. But before that, it was very much like outside in a space that's away from kind of like any distractions. You get a good cup of tea and you sit and listen to music and you write.
You mentioned tea. I think I saw on your website that you've got a tea library. So tell me about that.
Oh my God, I'm obsessed about tea. Like I didn't grow up like being crazy about tea. I know people in India mostly are very crazy. Like my parents are crazy about tea as well. But it's very like Indian chai, not like the variety of teas. I think to me it's more about the moment where you can't rush it. Like you have to boil the water for each tea. It has to be a specific temperature. You have to strain it just so. You have to sit and enjoy it. You can't rush it because you literally burn your tongue. So you have to just be very like patient, which is not something I can say I am in my other parts of my life. So it kind of forces me to like slow down a little bit.
Is there a particular tea that you always drink?
I usually prefer Earl Grey or Jasmine Pearls, depending on time of the day. But at any given day, I've basically had like, you'll see like 3 cups of tea on my, I have like 2 or 3 different types of tea during the day because like different times of the day, I feel like I want something, a different kind of flavor or a different kind of caffeine level.
Just to wrap up, I think you mentioned somewhere on your website or on Twitter that you are publishing a collection of poems. So how scared are you about publishing a collection?
Well, I think right now I'm in a bit of that still feels a bit far away because I don't have enough for a collection yet. Mm-hmm. So I'm building towards it, but I've kept it as like an end goal, but not put a timeline to it.
Okay.
So that I don't like scare myself. So I'm slowly doing it. And obviously things have been impacted a bit with COVID and the lack of imagination when you're just stuck indoors.
Yeah,
I think at this moment I'm looking at it as this like future beautiful thing. And maybe when I get closer to it, it'll start feeling a lot scarier.
Oh, definitely. I love it that you give yourself the space to just not worry about it and just enjoy it for now.
Yeah, it's because it's not like it's not work. I don't need to be like hyper achieving. Like it is the most nourishing thing for me. Like if I'm physically, mentally exhausted, like just literally an hour or of even less of poetry, and I'm literally completely recharged.